3D resulted from the exchange of virtual particles had to be due to the exchange of one or more of the particles already known or assumed to exist. Remembering how loath physicists such as Dirac and Pauli had been to propose new particles, even when they were correct, you can perhaps appreciate how radical Yukawa's idea was. As Yukawa later described it, quote, "At this period, the atomic nucleus was inconsistency itself, quite inexplicable. And why? Because our concept of elementary particle was too narrow. There was no such word in Japanese, and we used the English word. It meant proton and electron. From somewhere had come a divine message forbidding us to think about any other particle. To think outside of these limits, except for the photon, was to be arrogant, not to fear the wrath of the gods. It was because the concept that matter continues forever had been a tradition since the times of Democritus and Epicurus. To think about creation of particles other than photons was suspect, and there was a strong inhibition of such thoughts that was almost unconscious." End quote. One of my good physics friends has said that the only time he was able to do complicated calculations was after the birth of each of his children, when he couldn't sleep anyway, so he stayed up and worked. Thus, in October of 1934, just after the birth of his second child and unable to sleep, Yukawa realized that if the range of the strong nuclear force was to be restricted to the size of the nucleus, then any exchanged particle must be far more massive than the electron. The next morning, he estimated the mass to be 200 times the electron mass. It would have to carry an electric charge if it was to be exchanged between neutrons and protons, and it could have no spin, so as not to change the proton's or neutron's spin when it was absorbed or emitted. What is all this concern over strong nuclear forces to do with neutron decay, the subject that started this chapter and ended the last, you may ask? In the 1930s, just as it went against the grain to imagine new particles, so too inventing new forces seemed unnecessary at best and heretical at worst. Physicists were convinced that all the processes that occurred in the nucleus, strong or weak, must be connected. Yukawa envisaged a clever way to do this, connecting ideas of both Fermi and Heisenberg, and also generalizing ideas from the successful quantum theory of electromagnetism. If instead of emitting a photon, neutrons in the nucleus emitted a new, heavy, spinless charged particle, which Yukawa originally called a mesotron, until Heisenberg corrected Yukawa's Greek and the name was shortened to meson, then that particle could be absorbed by protons in the nucleus, producing a force of attraction whose magnitude Yukawa was able to calculate using equations that were extrapolated from, you guessed it, electromagnetism. The analogy with electromagnetism could not be exact, however, because the meson is massive and the photon is massless. Yukawa took the attitude that Fermi might have, if he had thought of it. Yes, the theory wasn't complete, but Yukawa was willing to ignore the other aspects of electromagnetism that this theory couldn't reproduce. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Yukawa ingeniously, and ultimately incorrectly, connected this strong force to observe neutron decay by suggesting that the mesons might not always simply be exchanged between neutrons and protons in the nucleus. A small fraction of the mesons emitted by neutrons might decay en route into an electron and a neutrino before they could be reabsorbed, causing neutron decay. In this case, the neutron decay would not be described by something like the PDF attached figure 11A on the left-hand side, where the decay and the emission of other particles all occur at a single point. It would appear like the right-hand side of the figure, where the decay gets spread out and a new particle, shown by the dashed line, which represents Yukawa's meson, travels a short distance after emission before decaying into the electron and neutrino. With the new intermediate particle, the weak interaction mediating neutron decay begins to look more like the electromagnetic interaction between charged particles. Yukawa had proposed a new intermediate particle, a heavy meson, which made neutron decay look similar to the earlier picture of photon exchange in electromagnetism, which had motivated his thinking in the first place, but with significant differences. In this case, the intermediate particle was both massive and electrically charged, and also, unlike the photon, it had no spin angular momentum. Nevertheless, Yukawa was able to show that for a heavy meson, his theory would be indistinguishable from Fermi's point interaction describing neutron decay, at least for predicting the details of neutron decay. In addition, Yukawa's theory offered the possibility of reducing all of the strange properties of the nucleus, from beta decay of neutrons inside the nucleus to the strength of the interaction binding together protons and neutrons, to merely understanding the properties of a single new interaction due to the exchange of a new particle, his meson. However, if this new heavy meson existed, where was it? Why hadn't it yet been seen in cosmic rays? Because of this, and also because Yukawa was an unknown entity, working in a location far from all the action, no real attention was paid to his proposal to explain both the strong interaction between nucleons and the weaker one that appeared to be responsible for neutron decay. Nevertheless, his proposal, unlike those of Heisenberg and others, including Fermi, was simpler and made more sense. All of this changed in 1936, less than 2 years after Yukawa's prediction, when Carl Anderson, the discoverer of the positron, together with collaborator Seth Neddermeyer, discovered what appeared to be a new set of particles in cosmic rays. The characteristics of the tracks of these new particles in cloud chambers implied that they produced too little radiation in traversing matter to be protons or electrons. They were also more massive than electrons and appeared to be sometimes negative and sometimes positive. Before long, the new particles were determined to have a mass in the range that Yukawa had predicted, about 200 times the mass of the electron. It is remarkable how quickly the rest of the world caught on. Yukawa published a short note to point out that his theory predicted just such particles. Within weeks, the major physicists in Europe began exploring his model and incorporating his ideas in their work. In 1938, in the last major conference before the Second World War interrupted essentially all international collaborations in science, of the 8 main speakers, 3 dealt with Yukawa's theory, citing a name they would have been unfamiliar with a year or two before. While much of the rest of the physics world celebrated the apparent discovery of Yukawa's meson, this discovery was not without its own problems. In 1940, the decay of a meson to an electron, predicted by Yukawa, was observed in cosmic ray tracks. However, over the years 1943 to 1947, it became clear that the particles Anderson and Neddermeyer had discovered interacted much more weakly with nuclei than Yukawa's particle should have. Something was wrong. 3 of Yukawa's Japanese colleagues suggested that mesons were of 2 different sorts, and that a Yukawa-type meson might decay into yet another different and more weakly interacting meson. But their articles were in Japanese and didn't appear in English until after the war, by which time a similar proposal had been made by the U.S. physicist Robert Marshak. This delay proved fortuitous. New techniques were being developed to observe the tracks of cosmic rays in photographic emulsions, and a series of brave researchers dragged their equipment up to high elevations to search for possible new signals. Many cosmic rays interact and disappear before reaching sea level. So this group and others interested in exploring this wondrous new source of particles coming from the heavens had no choice but to seek higher elevations. Here, cosmic rays would have traversed less distance in the atmosphere and might be more easily detected. The former Italian mountain guide turned physicist Giuseppe Occhialini had been invited from Brazil to join a British team working on the A-bomb during the war. As a foreign national, he couldn't work on the project, so instead he joined the cosmic ray physics group at Bristol. Occhialini's mountain training proved useful as he dragged photographic emulsions up to the Pic du Midi at 2,800 meters in France. Today you can travel to the observatory on top of this peak by cable car, and it is a terrifyingly exciting ride. But in 1946, Occhialini had to climb to the top, risking his health in the effort to discover signals of exotic new physics. And he and his team did discover exotic new physics. As Cecil Powell, Occhialini's collaborator at Bristol and future Nobel laureate, while Occhialini, who had done the climbing, did without, put it, they saw, quote, a whole new world. It was as if suddenly we had broken into a walled orchard where protected trees flourished and all kinds of exotic fruits had ripened in great profusion, end quote. Less poetically, perhaps, what they discovered were two examples in which an initial meson stopped in the emulsion and gave rise to a second meson, just as had been suggested by the theorists. Many more events were observed with emulsions taken to an elevation almost twice as high as Pic du Midi. In October of 1947, in the journal Nature, Powell, Occhialini, and Powell's student César Lat published a paper in which they named the initial meson the pion, which seemed to interact with the nuclear strength appropriate to Yukawa's meson, and the subsequent meson, the muon. It seemed at long last that Yukawa's meson had been discovered. As for its partner, the muon, which had been confused with Yukawa's meson, it was nothing of the sort. Not spinless, it had the same spin as the electron and the proton, and its interactions with matter were nowhere near strong enough to play a role in nuclear binding. The muon turned out to be simply a heavy, if unstable, copy of the electron, which is what motivated Rabi's question, who ordered that. So, the particle that made Yukawa famous wasn't the particle he predicted after all. His idea became famous because the original experimental result had been misinterpreted. Fortunately, the Nobel Committee waited until the 1947 discovery of the pion before awarding Yukawa their prize in 1949. But given the track record of errors and mislabeling, it is natural to wonder if the pion was in fact the particle Yukawa had predicted. The answer is both yes and no. Exchange of charged pions between protons and neutrons is indeed one accurate way of trying to estimate the strong nuclear force holding nuclei together. But in addition to charged pions, the mesons that Yukawa had predicted, there are neutral pions as well. Who ordered those? Moreover, the theory that Yukawa wrote down to describe the strong force, like Fermi's theory to describe neutron decay, was not fully mathematically consistent, as Yukawa had conceded when he proposed it. There was, at the time, no correct relativistic theory involving the exchange of massive particles. Something was still amiss, and a series of surprising experimental discoveries, combined with prescient theoretical ideas that were unfortunately applied to the wrong theories, helped lead to more than a decade of confusion before the fog lifted and light appeared at the end of the tunnel, or perhaps at the mouth of the cave. Chapter 12. March of the Titans. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 6. The relationship between theoretical insight and experimental discovery is one of the most interesting aspects of the progress of science. Physics is, at its heart, like all of science, an empirical discipline. Yet at times, brief bursts of theoretical insight change everything. Certainly, Einstein's insights into space and time in the first two decades of the 20th century are good examples, and the remarkable theoretical progress associated with the development of quantum mechanics by Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Pauli, Dirac, and others in the 1920s is another. Less heralded is another period, from 1954 to 1974, which, while not as revolutionary, will, when sufficient time has passed, be regarded as one of the most fruitful and productive theoretical physics eras in the 20th century. These two decades took us, not without turmoil, from chaos to order, from confusion to confidence, and from ugliness to beauty. It's a wild ride, with a few detours that might seem to come from left field, but bear with me. If you find it a tad uncomfortable, then recall what I said in the introduction about science and comfort. By putting yourself in the frame of mind of those involved in the quest, whose frustration eventually led to insights, the significance of the insights can be truly appreciated. This tumultuous period followed one in which experimental bombshells had produced widespread confusion, making nature curiouser and curiouser, as Lewis Carroll might have put it. The discoveries of the positron, and quickly thereafter the neutron, were just the beginning. Neutron decay, nuclear reactions, muons, pions, and a host of new elementary particles that followed made it appear as if fundamental physics was hopelessly complicated. The simple picture of a universe in which electromagnetism and gravity alone governed the interactions of matter, made from protons and electrons, disappeared into the dustbin of history. Some physicists at the time, like some in the political right today, yearned for the, often misremembered, simplicity of the good old days. This newfound complexity drove some, by the 1960s, to imagine that nothing was fundamental. In a Zen-like picture, they imagined that all elementary particles were made from all other elementary particles, and that even the notion of fundamental forces might be an illusion. Nevertheless, percolating in the background were theoretical ideas that would draw back the dark curtains of ignorance and confusion, revealing an underlying structure to nature that is as remarkable as it is strangely simple, and in one in which light would once again play a key role. It all began with two theoretical developments, one profound and unheralded, and another relatively straightforward but brilliant and immediately feted. Remarkably, the same man was involved in both. Born in 1922 to a mathematician father, Chen Ying Yang was educated in China, moving in 1938 from Beijing to Kunming to avoid the Japanese invasion of China. He graduated 4 years later from National Southwestern Associated University and remained there for another 2 years. There, he met another student who had been forced to relocate to Kunming, Sung Dao Li. While they only had a marginal acquaintance with the United States, in 1946, both of them received scholarships set up by the U.S. government with funds received from China to allow talented Chinese students to pursue graduate study in America. Yang had a master's degree and therefore had greater freedom to pursue a PhD and went with Fermi from Columbia to the University of Chicago. Li had less choice, as he did not have a master's degree, but the only U.S. university where he could work directly toward a PhD was also the University of Chicago. Yang did his PhD under the supervision of Edward Teller and worked directly with Fermi as his assistant for only a year after graduation, while Li did his PhD with Fermi directly. During the 1940s, the University of Chicago was one of the greatest centers of theoretical and experimental physics in the country, and its graduate students benefited from their exposure to a remarkable set of scientists, not only Fermi and Teller, but others including the brilliant but unassuming astrophysicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar. When he was 19, Chandra, as he was often called by colleagues, had proved that stars greater than 1.4 times the mass of the Sun must collapse catastrophically at the end of their nuclear burning lifetime, either through what is now known to be a supernova explosion, or directly in what is now known as a black hole. While his theory was ridiculed at the time, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for that work 53 years later. Chandra was not just a brilliant scientist, but like Fermi, a dedicated teacher. Even though he was pursuing research at the Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin, he drove 100 miles round trip each week to teach a class to just two registered students, Li and Yang. Ultimately, the entire class, professor included, became Nobel laureates, which is probably unique in the history of science. Yang moved to the venerable Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in 1949, where he nurtured his budding collaboration with Li on a variety of topics. In 1952, Yang was made a permanent member of the Institute, while Li moved in 1953 to nearby Columbia, New York City, where he remained for the rest of his career. Each of these men made major contributions to physics in a variety of areas. But the collaboration that made them famous began with a strange experimental result, again coming from cosmic ray observations. In the same year that Yang moved from Chicago to the IAS, Cecil Powell, the discoverer of the pion, discovered a new particle in cosmic rays, which he called the tau meson. This particle was observed to decay into three pions. Another new particle was discovered shortly thereafter, called the theta meson, which decayed into two pions. Surprisingly, this new particle turned out to have precisely the same mass and lifetime as the tau meson. This might not seem that strange. Might they be the same particle, simply observed to decay in two different ways? Remember that in quantum mechanics, anything that is not forbidden can happen. And as long as the new particle was heavy enough to decay into either two or three pions, and the weak force allowed such decays, both should occur. But, if it were sensible, the weak force shouldn't have allowed both decays. Think for a moment about your hands. Your left hand differs from your right hand. No simple physical process, short of entering through the looking glass, can convert one into the other. No series of movements, up or down, turning around, or jumping up and down, can turn one into the other. The forces that govern our experience, electromagnetism and gravity, are blind to the distinction between left and right. No process moderated by either force can turn something such as your right hand into its mirror image. I cannot turn your right hand into your left hand merely by shining light on it, for example. Put another way, if I shine a light on your right hand and look at it from a distance, the intensity of reflected light will be the same as it would be if I did the same thing to your left hand. The light doesn't care about left or right when it is reflected off something. Our definition of left and right is imposed by human convention. Tomorrow, we could decide that left is right and vice versa, and nothing would change except our labels. As I write this on an airplane flying economy class, the person to my right may be quite different from the person to my left. But again, that is just an accident of my circumstances. I don't expect that the laws governing the flight of this plane are different for the right wing than for the left wing. Think about this in the subatomic world. Recall that Enrico Fermi found that, given the rules of quantum mechanics, the mathematical behavior of groups or pairs of elementary particles depends upon whether they have spin a half, i.e., are fermions. The behavior of groups of fermions is quite different from the behavior of particles such as photons, which have a spin value of 1, or any integer value of spin angular momentum, i.e., 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. The mathematical wave function that describes a pair of fermions, for example, is antisymmetric, while one describing a pair of photons is symmetric. This means that if one interchanges one particle with another, the wave function describing fermions changes sign. But for particles such as photons, the wave function remains the same under such an interchange. Interchanging two particles is the same as reflecting them in the mirror. The one on the left now becomes the one on the right. Thus, an intimate connection exists between such exchanges and what physicists call parity, which is the overall property of a system under reflection, i.e., interchanging left and right. If an elementary particle decays into two other particles, the wave function describing the parity of the final state, i.e., whether the wave function changes sign or not under left-right interchange of the particles, allows us then to assign a quantity we call parity to the initial particle. In quantum mechanics, if the force that governs the decay is blind to left and right, then the decay will not change the parity of the quantum state of the system. If the wave function of the system is antisymmetric under interchange of the particles after the decay, then the system has negative parity. In this case, the wave function describing the initial quantum state of the decaying particle must also have negative parity, i.e., it would change sign if left and right were interchanged. Now, pions, the particles discovered by Powell and hypothesized by Yukawa, have negative parity, so that the wave function that describes the quantum state of their mirror image would change sign compared to the original wave function. The distinction between positive and negative parity is kind of like considering first a nice spherical ball, which looks identical when reflected in the mirror, and hence has positive parity, versus, say, your hand, which changes character from left to right when reflected in a mirror, and could therefore be said to have negative parity. These somewhat abstract considerations made the observed data on the decays of the new particles that Powell discovered perplexing. Because a pion has negative parity, two pions would have positive parity, since negative 1 squared equals 1. A system of three pions, however, would, by the same consideration, have negative parity, since negative 1 cubed is negative 1. Therefore, if parity doesn't change when a particle decays, a single original particle cannot decay into two different final states of different parity. If the force responsible for the decay behaved like all the other known forces at the time, such as electromagnetism or gravity, it would be blind to parity. It would not distinguish between right and left. So it shouldn't change the original parity of the system after the decay. Just as shining a light on your right hand will not cause it to look like your left hand. Since it seemed impossible for a single type of particle to decay sometimes into two and sometimes into three pions, the solution seems simple. There must be two different elementary particles with opposite parity properties. Powell dubbed these the tau particle and the theta particle, one of which could decay into two pions and one into three pions. Observations suggested that the two particles had precisely the same masses and lifetimes, which was a bit strange, but Li and Yang proposed that this might be a general property for various elementary particles, which they suggested might come in pairs with opposite parity. They called this idea parity doubling. Such was the situation in the spring of 1956 when the International Conference on High Energy Physics, held every year at the University of Rochester, took place. In 1956, the entire community of physicists interested in particle and nuclear physics could fit in a single university lecture hall, and these physicists, including all the major players, tended to gather at this annual meeting. Richard Feynman was sharing a room at the meeting with Marty Bloch. Being an experimentalist, Bloch was not as burdened by possible heresy inherent in the suggestion that some force in nature was not blind to the distinction between right and left. And he asked Feynman if possibly the weak interaction governing the decays Powell observed might distinguish right from left. This would allow a single particle to decay to states of differing parity, meaning the tau and theta could both be the same particle. Bloch didn't have the temerity to raise this question in the public session, but Feynman did, even though he privately thought this was extremely unlikely. Yang replied that he and Li had thought about this, but so far nothing had come of the idea. Eugene Wigner, who would later win a Nobel Prize for elucidating the importance of such things as parity in atomic and nuclear physics, was also present, and he too raised the same question about the weak interaction. But to the victor go the spoils, and speculating about the possible violation of parity by a new force in nature that might distinguish left from right was different from demonstrating it. A month later, Li and Yang were at a cafe in New York, and they decided to examine all known experiments involving the weak interaction to see if any of them could dispel the possibility of parity violation. To their great surprise, they realized that not a single one definitively resolved the issue. As Yang later said, quote, "The fact that parity conservation in the weak interaction was believed for so long without experimental support was very startling. But what was more startling was the prospect that a space-time symmetry law, which the physicists have learned so well, may be violated. This prospect did not appeal to us." End quote. To their credit, Li and Yang proposed a variety of experiments that could test the possibility that the weak interaction distinguished right from left. They suggested considering the beta decay of a neutron in the nucleus of cobalt-60. Because this radioactive nucleus has non-zero spin, angular momentum, i.e. it behaves like it is spinning, it also acts like a little magnet. In an external magnetic field, the nuclei will line up in the direction of the field. If the electron emitted when a neutron in the nucleus decays preferentially ends up in one hemisphere instead of another, this would be a sign of parity violation, because in the mirror, the electrons would end up in the opposite hemisphere. If this was true, then at a fundamental level, nature would be able to distinguish right from left. The human-created distinctions between them, i.e. sinister versus good, would not then be totally artificial. Thus, the world in a mirror could be distinguished from the real world. Or, as Richard Feynman poetically put it later, we could use this experiment to send a message to tell a Martian what direction is left, say the hemisphere where more electrons were observed to emerge, without drawing a picture. At the time, this was viewed as such a long shot that many in the physics community were amused, but no one ran out to perform the experiment. No one, that is, except Lee's colleague at Columbia, the experimentalist Xian Xiong Wu, known as Madame Wu. Even as we bemoan today the paucity of female physicists trained at American institutions, the situation was much worse in 1956. After all, women weren't even admitted as undergraduates at Ivy League institutions until the late 1960s. Almost 30 years after Wu arrived from China to study at Berkeley in 1936, she noted in a Newsweek article about her, quote, "It is shameful that there are so few women in science. In China, there are many, many women in physics. There is a misconception in America that women scientists are dowdy spinsters. This is the fault of men. In Chinese society, a woman is valued for what she is, and men encourage her to accomplishments, yet she remains eternally feminine." End quote. Be that as it may, Wu was an expert in neutron decay and became intrigued by the tantalizing possibility of searching for parity violation in the weak interaction after learning of it from her friends Li and Yang. She canceled a European vacation with her husband and embarked on an experiment in June, 1 month after Li and Yang had first thought of the problem. And by October of that year, the same month Li and Yang's paper appeared in print, she and several colleagues had assembled the apparatus necessary to do the experiment. 2 days after Christmas of that year, they had a result. In modern times, particle physics experiments might take decades from design to completion, but that was not the case in the 1950s. It was also a time when physicists apparently didn't bother to take holidays. Despite its being the Yuletide, the Friday Chinese lunches organized by Li continued, and the first Friday after New Year's Day, Li announced that Wu's group had discovered that not only was parity violated, but it was violated by the maximum amount possible in the experiment. The result was so surprising that Wu's group continued their work to ensure they weren't being fooled by an experimental glitch. Meanwhile, Leon Letterman and colleagues Dick Garwin and Marcel Weinrich, also at Columbia, realized they could check the result in their experiments on pion and muon decays at Columbia's cyclotron. Within a week, both groups, as well as Jerry Friedman and Val Telegdi in Chicago, independently confirmed the result with high confidence. And by mid-January 1957, they submitted their papers to the Physical Review. They changed our picture of the world forever. Columbia University called what was probably the first press conference ever announcing a scientific result. Feynman lost a $50 bet, but Wolfgang Pauli was luckier. He had written a letter from Zurich on January 15th to Victor Weisskopf at MIT, betting that Wu's experiment would not show parity violation, not knowing that the experiment already had. Pauli explained in the letter, quote, "I refuse to believe that God is a weak left-hander," end quote, demonstrating an interesting appreciation for baseball as well. Weisskopf, who by then knew of the actual result, was too kind to take the bet. Upon hearing the news, Pauli later wrote, quote, "Now that the first shock is over, I begin to collect myself," end quote. It really was a shock. The idea that one of the fundamental forces in nature distinguished between left and right flew in the face of common sense, as well as much of the basis of modern physics as it was then understood. The shock was so great that, for one of the few times in the history of the Nobel Prizes, Nobel's will was actually carried out properly. His will stipulates that the prize should go to the person or persons in each field whose work that year was the most important. In October of 1957, almost exactly a year from the publication of Li and Yang's paper, and only 10 months after Wu and Letterman confirmed the notion, the 30-year-old Li and the baby-faced 34-year-old Yang shared the Nobel Prize for their proposal. Sadly, Madame Wu, known as the Chinese Madame Curie, had to be content with winning the inaugural Wolf Prize in physics 20 years later. Suddenly, the weak interaction became more interesting, and also more confusing. Fermi's theory, which had sufficed up to that point, was roughly modeled after electromagnetism. We can think of the electromagnetism interaction as a force between two different electric currents, each corresponding to the two separate moving electrons that interact with each other. The weak interaction could be thought of in a somewhat similar way. If in one current, a neutron, during the interaction, converts into a proton, and in the other current is an outgoing electron and neutrino. There are two crucial differences, however. In Fermi's weak interaction, the two different currents interact at a single point rather than at a distance. And the currents in the weak interaction allow particles to change from one type to another as they extend through space. While electromagnetic interactions are the same in the mirror as they are in the real world, if parity is violated in the weak interaction, the currents involved would have to have a handedness, as Pauli alluded, as for example, a corkscrew or a pair of scissors has, so that their mirror images will not be the same. Parity violation in weak interactions would then be like the social rule that we always shake hands with a right hand. In a mirror world, people would always shake with their left hand. Thus, the real world differs from the mirror image. If the currents of the weak interaction had a handedness, then the weak interaction could distinguish right from left, and in a mirror world would be different from the force in the world in which we live. A great deal of work and confusion resulted as physicists tried to figure out precisely what types of new possible interaction could replace Fermi's simple current-to-current interaction, in which no apparent handedness could be attributed to the particles involved. Relativity allowed a variety of possible generalizations of Fermi's interaction, but the results of different experiments led to different, mutually exclusive mathematical forms for the interaction, so it appeared impossible that one universal weak interaction could explain all of them. Around the time when the first experimental results on neutron and muon decay had come out suggesting that parity violation was as large as it could be, a young graduate student at the University of Rochester, George Sudarshan, began exploring the confused situation and came up with what eventually was the correct form of a universal interaction that could replace Fermi's form, something that also required that at least some of the experimental results at the time were wrong. The rest of the story is a bit tragic. At the Rochester conference, 3 months after the parity violation discovery, and a year after Li and Yang had presented their first thoughts on parity doubling, Sudarshan asked to present his results. But because he was a graduate student, he wasn't allowed. His supervisor, Robert Marshak, who had suggested the research problem to Sudarshan, was by then preoccupied with another problem in nuclear physics and chose to present a talk on that subject at the meeting. Another faculty member who was asked to mention Sudarshan's work also forgot. So all of the discussion at the meeting on the possible form of the weak interaction ended up leading nowhere. Earlier, in 1947, Marshak had been the first to suggest that two different mesons were discovered in Cecil Powell's experiments, with one being the particle proposed by Yukawa, and the other being the particle now called a muon. Marshak was also the originator of the Rochester conferences, and probably felt it would show favoritism to allow his own student to speak. In addition, since Sudarshan's idea required at least some of the experimental data to be wrong, Marshak may have decided it was premature to present it at the meeting. That summer, Marshak was working at the Rand Corporation in Los Angeles and invited Sudarshan and another student to join him. The two most renowned particle theorists in the world then, Feynman and Murray Gell-Mann, were at Caltech, and each had become obsessed with unraveling the form of the weak interaction. Feynman had missed out on the discovery of parity violation by not following his own line of questioning, but had since realized that his work on quantum electrodynamics could shed light on the weak interaction. He desperately wanted to do this because he felt his work on QED was simply a bit of technical wizardry and far less noble than unearthing the form of the law governing another of the fundamental interactions in nature. But Feynman's proposal for the form of the weak interaction also appeared to disagree with experiments at the time. Over the 1950s, Gell-Mann would produce many of the most important and lasting ideas in particle physics from that time. He was one of two physicists to propose that protons and neutrons were made of more fundamental particles, which he called quarks. He had his own reasons for thinking about parity and the weak interaction. Much of his success was based on focusing on new mathematical symmetries in nature, and he had used these ideas to come up with a new possible form for the weak interaction as well. But again, his idea conflicted with experiment. While they were in L.A., Marshak arranged for Sudarshan to have lunch with Gell-Mann to talk about their ideas. They also met with an eminent experimentalist, Felix Bohm, whose experiments, he said, were now consistent with their ideas. Sudarshan and Marshak learned from Gell-Mann that his ideas were consistent with Sudarshan's proposal, but that at best Gell-Mann was planning to include the notion in one paragraph of a long, general paper on the weak interaction. Meanwhile, Marshak and Sudarshan prepared a paper on their idea, and Marshak decided to save it for a presentation at an international conference in Italy in the fall. Learning of the new experimental data from Bohm, Feynman decided, rather excitedly, that his ideas were correct and began to write a paper on the subject. Gell-Mann, who was competitive in the extreme, decided he too should write up a paper since Feynman was writing one. Eventually, their department chairman convinced them they needed to write their paper together, which they did, and it became famous. Although the paper had an acknowledgement to Sudarshan and Marshak for discussions, their paper appeared later in the conference proceedings and could not compete for the attention of the community. Later in 1963, Feynman, who tried to be generous with ideas, publicly stated, quote, "The theory that was discovered by Sudarshan and Marshak, publicized by Feynman and Gell-Mann," end quote. But it was too little too late. It would have been hard in the best of times to compete in the limelight with Feynman and Gell-Mann, and Sudarshan had to live for years with the knowledge that the universal form of the weak interaction, which two of the world's physics heroes had discovered, was first proposed, and with more confidence, by him. Sudarshan's theory, as elucidated beautifully in Feynman and Gell-Mann's paper, became known as the V minus A theory of the weak interaction. The reason for the name is technical and will make more sense in coming chapters, but the fundamental idea is simple, though it sounds both ridiculous and meaningless. The currents in the Fermi theory must be, quote, left-handed, end quote. To understand this terminology, recall that in quantum mechanics, elementary particles such as electrons, protons, and neutrinos have spin angular momentum. They behave as if they are spinning, even though classically a point particle without extension can't be pictured as spinning. Now consider the direction of their motion and pretend for a moment the particle is like a top spinning around that axis. Put your right hand out and let your thumb point in the direction of the particle's motion. Then curl your other fingers around. If they are curling in the same counterclockwise direction that the particle top is spinning about the direction of motion, the particle is said to be right-handed. If you put your left hand out and do the same thing, a left-handed particle would be spinning clockwise to match the direction of your left curled hand, as can be seen in the attached PDF, figure 12A. Just as viewing your left hand in a mirror will make it look like a right hand, if you see a spinning arrow in the mirror, its direction of motion will be flipped, so that if the arrow is moving away from you in the real world, it will be moving toward you in the mirror. But the spin will not be flipped. Thus, in the mirror, a left-handed particle will turn into a right-handed particle. And so, if the poor souls in Plato's cave had had mirrors, they might have felt less strange about the shadows of arrows slipping direction. This working picture of left-handed particles is not exact, because if you think about it, you can also turn a left-handed particle into a right-handed particle by simply moving faster than the particle. In the frame in which a person at rest observes the particle zipping by, it may be moving to the left. But if you hop in a rocket and head off to the left and pass by that particle, then relative to you, it is moving to the right. As a result, only for particles that are massless and are therefore moving at the speed of light is the previous description exact. For if a particle is moving at the speed of light, nothing can move fast enough to pass the particle. Mathematically, the definition of left-handed has to take this effect into account. But this complication need not concern us anymore here. Electrons can spin in either direction. But what the V minus A interaction implies mathematically is that only those moving electrons whose currents are left-handed can feel the weak force and participate in neutron decay. Right-handed currents don't feel the force. What is more amazing is that neutrinos only feel the weak force and no other force. As far as we can tell, neutrinos are only left-handed. It is not just that only one sort of neutrino current engages in the weak interaction. In all the experimental observations so far, there are no right-handed neutrinos. Perhaps the most explicit demonstration of the violation of parity in nature. The seeming silliness of this nomenclature was underscored to me years ago when I was watching a Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode, during which a science officer in the space station discovers something wrong with the laws of probability in a gaming casino. She sends a neutrino beam through the facility, and the neutrinos are observed to be coming out only left-handed. Clearly something was wrong. Except that is the way it really is. What is wrong with nature? How come, for at least one of the fundamental forces, left is different than right? And why should neutrinos be so special? The simple answer to these questions is that we don't yet know. Even though our very existence, which derives from the nature of the known forces, ultimately depends on it. That is one reason we are trying to find out. The elucidation of a new force led to a new puzzle, and like most puzzles in science, it ultimately provided the key that would lead physicists down a new path of discovery. Learning that nature lacked the left-right symmetry that everyone had assumed was fundamental led physicists to re-examine how symmetries are manifested in the world, and more important, how they are not. Chapter 13. Endless Forms Most Beautiful. Symmetry Strikes Back. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Borrowing from Pauli, we can say that Mother Nature is a weak left-hander. With the shocking realization that nature distinguishes left from right, physics itself took a strange left turn down a road with no familiar guideposts. The beautiful order of the periodic table governing phenomena on atomic scales gave way to the mystery of the nucleus and the inscrutable nature of the forces that governed it. Gone were the seemingly simple days of light, motion, electromagnetism, gravity, and quantum mechanics. The spectacularly successful theory of quantum electrodynamics, which had previously occupied the forefront of physics, seemed to be replaced by a confusing world of exotic phenomena associated with the other two newly discovered weak and strong nuclear forces that governed the heart of matter. Their effects and properties could not easily be isolated, despite that one force was thousands of times stronger than the other. The world of fundamental particles appeared to be ever more complicated, and the situation was getting more confusing with each passing year. If the discovery of parity violation created shadows of confusion by demonstrating that nature had completely unexpected preferences, the first rays of light arose from the realization that other nuclear quantities, which on the surface seemed quite different, might, when viewed from a fundamental perspective, be not so different after all. Perhaps the most important discovery in nuclear physics was that protons and neutrons could convert into each other, as Yukawa has speculated years earlier. This was the basis of the emerging understanding of the weak interaction. But most physicists felt it was also the key to understanding the strong force that appeared to hold nuclei together. 2 years before his revolutionary work with T.D. Lee, exposing the demise of the sacred left-right symmetry of nature, C.N. Yang had concentrated his efforts on trying to understand how a different type of symmetry, born from quantum electrodynamics, might reveal an otherwise hidden beauty inside the nucleus. Perhaps, as Galileo discovered regarding the basis of motion, the most obvious things we observe about nature are also the things that most effectively mask its fundamental properties. What had slowly become clear, not only from the progress in understanding neutron decay and other weak effects in nuclei, but also from looking at strong nuclear collisions, was that the obvious distinction between protons and neutrons, the proton is charged and the neutron is neutral, might, as far as the underlying physics governing the nucleus is concerned, be irrelevant, or at least as irrelevant as the apparent distinction between a falling feather and a falling rock is to our understanding of the underlying physics of gravity and falling objects. First off, the weak force could convert protons into neutrons. More important, when one examined the rates of other stronger nuclear reactions involving proton or neutron collisions, replacing neutrons by protons and vice versa didn't significantly change the results. In 1932, the year the neutron was discovered, Heisenberg had suggested that the neutron and proton might be just two states of the same particle. And he invented a parameter he called isotopic spin to distinguish them. After all, their masses are almost the same, and light stable nuclei contain equal numbers of them. Following this, and after the recognition by the distinguished nuclear physicists Benedict Cassin, Edward Condon, Gregory Bright, and Eugene Feinberg, that nuclear reactions seem to be largely blind to distinguishing protons and neutrons, the brilliant mathematical physicist Eugene Wigner suggested that isotopic spin was conserved in nuclear reactions, implying an underlying symmetry governing the nuclear force between protons and neutrons. Wigner had earlier developed rules demonstrating how symmetries in atomic systems ultimately allowed a complete classification of atomic states and the transitions between them, for which he later won the Nobel Prize. Earlier, when discussing electromagnetism, I noted that the net electric charge doesn't change during electromagnetic interactions, i.e., electric charge is conserved, because of an underlying symmetry between positive and negative charges. The underlying connection between conservation laws and symmetries is far broader and far deeper than this one example. The deep and unexpected relationship between conservation laws and symmetries of nature has been the single most important guiding principle in physics in the past century. In spite of its importance, the precise mathematical relationship between conservation laws and symmetries was only made explicit in 1915 by the remarkable German mathematician Emmy Noether. Sadly, although she was one of the most important mathematicians in the early 20th century, Noether worked without official position or pay for much of her career. Noether had two strikes against her. First, she was a woman, which made obtaining education and employment during her early career difficult. And second, she was Jewish, which ultimately ended her academic career in Germany and resulted in her exile to the United States shortly before she died. She managed to attend the University of Erlangen as one of two female students out of 986. But even then, she was only allowed to audit classes after receiving special permission from individual professors. Nevertheless, she passed the graduation exam and later studied at the famed University of Göttingen for a short period before returning to Erlangen to complete her PhD thesis. After working for 7 years at Erlangen as an instructor without pay, She was invited in 1915 to return to Göttingen by the famous mathematician David Hilbert. Historians and philosophers among the faculty, however, blocked her appointment. As one member protested, quote, "What will our soldiers think when they return to the university and find that they are required to learn at the feet of a woman?" End quote. In a retort that eternally reinforced my admiration for Hilbert, beyond that for his remarkable talent as a mathematician, he replied, quote, "I do not see that the sex of the candidate is an argument against her admission as a Privatdozent. After all, we are a university, not a bathhouse." End quote. Hilbert was overruled, however, and while Noether spent the next 17 years teaching at Göttingen, she was not paid until 1923, and in spite of her remarkable contribution to many areas of mathematics, so many and so deep that she's often considered one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, she was never promoted to the position of professor. Nevertheless, in 1915, shortly after arriving at Göttingen, she proved a theorem that is now known as Noether's theorem, which all graduate students in physics learn, or should learn, if they are to call themselves physicists. Returning again to electromagnetism, the relationship between the arbitrary distinction between positive and negative, had Benjamin Franklin had a better understanding of nature when he defined positive charge, electrons would today probably be labeled as positive, not negative charge, and the conservation of electric charge, namely, that the total charge in a system before and after any physical reaction doesn't change, is not at all obvious. It is in fact a consequence of Noether's theorem, which states that for every fundamental symmetry of nature, namely, for every transformation under which the laws of nature appear unchanged, some associated physical quantity is conserved. In other words, some physical quantity doesn't change over time as physical systems evolve. Thus, the conservation of electric charge reflects that the laws of nature don't change if the sign of all electric charges is changed. The conservation of energy reflects that the laws of nature don't change with time. The conservation of momentum reflects that the laws of nature don't change from place to place. The conservation of angular momentum reflects that the laws of nature don't depend on which direction a system is rotated. Hence, the claimed conservation of isotopic spin in nuclear reactions is a reflection of the experimentally verified claim that nuclear interactions remain roughly the same if all protons are changed into neutrons and vice versa. It is reflected as well in the world of our experience, in that for light elements at least, the number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus is roughly the same. In 1954, Yang, and his collaborator at the time, Robert Mills, went one important step further, once again thinking about light. Electromagnetism and quantum electrodynamics do not just have the simple symmetry that tells us that there is no fundamental difference between negative charge and positive charge, and that the label is arbitrary. As I have described at length earlier, a much more subtle symmetry is at work as well, one that ultimately determines the complete form of electrodynamics. Gauge symmetry in electromagnetism tells us that we can change the definition of positive and negative charge locally without changing the physics, as long as there is a field, in this case the electromagnetic field, that can account for any such local alterations to ensure that the long-range forces between charges are independent of this relabeling. The consequence of this in quantum electrodynamics is the existence of a massless particle, the photon, which is the quantum of the electromagnetic field and which conveys the force between distant particles. In this sense, that gauge invariance is a symmetry of nature ensures that electromagnetism has precisely the form it has. The interactions between charged particles and light are prescribed by this symmetry. Yang and Mills then asked what would happen if one extended the symmetry that implies that we could interchange neutrons and protons everywhere without changing the physics into a symmetry that allows us to change what we label as a neutron and proton differently from place to place, Clearly, by analogy with quantum electrodynamics, some new field would be required to account for and neutralize the effect of these arbitrarily varying labels from place to place. If this field is a quantum field, then could the particles associated with this field somehow play a role in or completely determine the nature of the nuclear forces between protons and neutrons? These were fascinating questions. And to their credit, Yang and Mills didn't merely ask them. They tried to determine the answers by exploring specifically what the mathematical implications of such a new type of gauge symmetry associated with isotopic spin conservation would be. It became clear immediately that things would get much more complicated. In quantum electrodynamics, merely switching the sign of charges between electrons and positrons does not change the magnitude of the net charge on each particle. However, relabeling the particles in the nucleus replaces a neutral neutron with a positively charged proton. Therefore, whatever new field must be introduced in order to cancel out the effect of such a local transformation, so that the underlying physics is unchanged, must itself be charged. But if the field is itself charged, then unlike photons, which being neutral don't themselves interact directly with other photons, this new field would also have to interact with itself. Introducing the need for a new charged generalization of the electromagnetic field makes the mathematics governing the theory much more complex. In the first place, to account for all such isotopic spin transformations, one would need not just one such field, but three fields, one positively charged, one negatively charged, and one neutral. This means that a single field at each point in space, like the electromagnetic field in QED, which points in a certain direction in space with a certain magnitude, and is called a vector field in physics for this reason, is not sufficient. The electric field must be replaced by a field described by a mathematical object called a matrix, not to be confused with anything having to do with Keanu Reeves. Yang and Mills explored the mathematics behind this new and more complex type of gauge symmetry, which today we call either a non-abelian gauge symmetry, arising from a particular mathematical property of matrices that makes multiplying them different from multiplying numbers, or, in deference to Yang and Mills, a Yang-Mills symmetry. Yang and Mills' article appears at first glance to be an abstract or purely speculative mathematical exploration of the implications of a guess about the possible form of a new interaction, motivated by the observation of gauge symmetry in electromagnetism. Nevertheless, it was not an exercise in pure mathematics. The paper tried to explore possible observable consequences of the hypothesis to see if it might relate to the real world. Unfortunately, the mathematics was sufficiently complicated such that the possible observable signatures were not so obvious. One thing was clear, however. If the new gauge fields were to account for and thus cancel out the effects of separate isotopic spin transformations made in distant locations, the fields would have to be massless. This is equivalent to saying that only because photons are massless can the force they transmit between particles be arbitrarily long range. To return to my chessboard analogy, you need a single rule book to tell you how to properly move over the entire board if I have previously changed the colors of the board randomly from place to place. But having massive gauge fields, which cannot be exchanged over arbitrarily long distances, is equivalent to having a rule book that tells you how to compensate for changing colors only on nearby squares around your starting point. But this would not allow you to move pieces across the board to distant locations. In short, a gauge symmetry, such as that in electromagnetism, or in the more esoteric Yang-Mills proposal, only works if the new fields required by the symmetry are massless. Amid all the mathematical complexity, this one fact is inviolate. but we have observed in nature no long-range forces involving the exchange of massless particles other than electromagnetism and gravity. Nuclear interactions are short-range. They only apply over the size of the nucleus. This obvious problem was not lost on Yang and Mills, who recognized it and frankly punted. They proposed that somehow their new particles could become massive when they interacted with the nucleus. When they tried to estimate masses from first principles, they found the theory was too mathematically complicated to allow them to make reasonable estimates. All they knew was that empirically, the mass of the new gauge particles would have to be greater than that of pions in order to have avoided detection in then existing experiments. Such a willingness to throw their hands in the air might have seemed either lazy or unprofessional, but Yang and Mills knew, as Yukawa had known before them, that no one had been able to write down a sensible quantum field theory of a particle like a photon, but one that, unlike the photon, had a mass. So it didn't seem worthwhile at the time to try to solve all the problems of quantum field theory at once. Instead, with less irreverence than Jonathan Swift, they merely presented their paper as a modest proposal to spur the imagination of their colleagues. Wolfgang Pauli, however, would have none of it. While he had thought of some related ideas a year earlier, he had discarded them. Moreover, he felt that all this talk about quantum uncertainties in estimating masses was a red herring. If there was to be a new gauge symmetry in nature associated with isotopic spin and governing nuclear forces, the new Yang-Mills particles, like the photon, would have to be massless. For these reasons, among others, the Yang-Mills paper made far less of a stir at the time than the later Yang and Lee opus. To most physicists, it was an interesting curiosity at best, and the discovery of parity violation seemed much more exciting. But not to Julian Schwinger, who was no ordinary physicist. A child prodigy who had graduated from university by the age of 18, he received his PhD by the age of 21. Perhaps no two physicists could have been as different as he and Richard Feynman, who shared the Nobel Prize in 1965 for their separate but equivalent work developing the theory of quantum electrodynamics. Schwinger was refined, formal, and brilliant. Feynman was brilliant, casual, and certainly not refined. Feynman relied often on intuition and guesswork, building on prodigious mathematical skill and experience. Schwinger's mathematical skill was every bit Feynman's equal, but Schwinger worked in an orderly fashion, manipulating complicated mathematical expressions with an ease not possible for ordinary mortals. He joked about Feynman diagrams, which Feynman had developed to make what had previously been perilously laborious calculations in quantum field theory manageable, saying, quote, "Like the silicon chips of more recent years, the Feynman diagram was bringing computation to the masses," end quote. Both of them shared one characteristic, however. They marched to the beat of a different drummer, in opposite directions. Schwinger took the Yang-Mills ideas seriously. The mathematical beauty must have appealed to him. In 1957, the same year that parity violation was discovered, Schwinger made a bold and seemingly highly unlikely suggestion that the weak interaction responsible for the decay of neutrons into protons, electrons, and neutrinos might benefit from the possibility of Yang-Mills fields, but in a new and remarkable way. He proposed that the observed gauge symmetry of electromagnetism might simply be one part of a larger gauge symmetry in which new gauge particles might mediate the weak interaction that caused neutrons to decay. An obvious objection to this kind of unification is that the weak interaction is far weaker than electromagnetism. Schwinger had an answer for this. If somehow the new gauge particles were very heavy, almost 100 times heavier than protons and neutrons, then the interaction they might mediate would be of much shorter range than even the size of a nucleus.